Karma can be a bitch. When you spend your entire life cheating, stealing, destroying lives, gloom and doom is bound to come back at you tenfold. So when a guy like Ron Thomas is found dead, the lists of suspects may at first appear endless, yet when you look at the context of the murder, there were only a few people who would benefit from Ron's death. One person who immediately comes to mind is Dick Weston. It would not be unimaginable to think the guy who has to spend the rest of his life in prison would want some retribution against the mastermind who walked free. As Detective Tom Cooper tells me, even though Dick Weston was locked up, the guy was known to have ties to the outside.
I'm sure he had connections through the prison system because he was spending his time down Terre Haute.
Before spending the rest of his days serving four consecutive life sentences, Dick Weston had to first complete the federal government's 25-year sentence at the prison in Terre Haute, Indiana.
And he was supposed to come to us after, and he never got to us.
The theories of Dick Weston taking out a hit on Ron Thomas ended in 1994, when Dick suffered a massive heart attack and died in prison. Previously on Paper Ghosts.
And we come to kind of like a dead end. And we spin around, and guess who is behind me? Ron Thomas. He had followed me. He had literally turned around and followed me down the steps.
You don't know where, if you lay down to take a nap or lay down to go to sleep, where you're going to wake up or not. You don't know where your kids is going to be, where you left them or not. Not with everything that was going on.
And I'm convinced that he knew his killer. There was no struggle in the home, and it didn't appear to be.
My name is M. William Phelps. I'm an investigative journalist and author of 44 true crime books. This is season 2 of Paper Ghosts, Burned. With any question of the mafia's involvement or Dick Weston's attempt at retaliation now off the table, the pool of people who could have killed Ron Thomas was shrinking. Those involved have their theories, as do I. It's been some time since I last spoke with Carol Thompson, the daughter of victims Linda and Billy Stevenson. After hearing her admit that she wanted to shoot Ron Thomas dead on the courthouse steps, and now learning that a potential hit was put out on Ron, I needed to call Carol and ask the obvious question. So knowing what happens to Ron later, I mean, a fair question is, because it's an unsolved case, did you kill Ron?
No, I did not. I understand you asking that question to me. That doesn't even offend me. I didn't understand at the time why the police didn't contact me or the,
This piece of information has always surprised me. For as diligent and tenacious as the Claremont County Sheriff's Department and FBI were in investigating the Stevenson case, it's bizarre why no one in law enforcement thought to question the surviving family member who made no secret about wanting to kill Ron Thomas. No one contacted you.
No. I was laying in bed asleep, and it was about, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something, and my phone rang, and it was my daughter, my oldest daughter, Shannon, and she said to me, Mom, you need to wake up. I got to tell you something. This is very important, and I'm like, Shannon's 2:30 a.m. or something. She's like, get to your computer. Go to your computer now. She immediately sent me a link, and I clicked the link, and it talked about, this cold case murder of Ronald Thomas. And I'm like, this can't be the same. This can't, come on, I'm blown away. He's murdered. So I did call the policeman over the cold case.
Carol spoke with Dave Bell, the former South Carolina detective who you've heard in the last few episodes.
I was about to be very, very happy, but I needed to know for sure, is the right guy. And So I asked him, I said, you know, I need to confirm that this is, you know, the same Ron from, you know, Brookville. And his answer surprised me because he said something to the effect of, if you're referring to the man who was in some ways linked to the Stevenson murder in Bethel, Ohio, then yes, this is the same man. I said to him right away, you know, I'm shocked. Why didn't, you know, I'm surprised. You know, I wanted the man dead. I'm surprised nobody called me. You know, this is a cold case. I'm shocked. And he kind of chuckled and he said, you know, Carol, I understand that. And he said, so let me ask you a question. And I said, what's that? And he said, did you murder Ron Thomas? And I said, absolutely not. But if you find out who did, let me know. I would like to send them some cookies and flowers and anything else they might need. You know, I wanted to thank them. My fear was, you know, this wasn't a man that was going to stop. If he saw money in his future, it wouldn't matter if it was a one-year-old, you know, he'd kill him. I didn't want anybody else to go through it.
There are three fundamental motivations behind murder. Love, money, revenge. Under the money umbrella, greed factors into about 75% of homicides in this country, according to experts and crime statisticians. It's clear to me Carol Thompson did not kill Ron Thomas. I am certain she can be ruled out as a suspect. But there is one other person who had a solid motive to want Ron dead. In the eyes of Dave Bell, who took up Ron Thomas's homicide case in the early 2000s, history seemed to be repeating itself.
You know, when we first looked into Ron's death, we looked at his wife as a suspect, Irene, in his murder. It didn't take long to realize that, yes, she was our number one suspect in his murder because of the pattern that she had. And her first and second husband's untimely death.
Looking back, Irene's first husband was accidentally killed by a train while trying to outrun cops after a domestic dispute. Her second husband was severely beaten, survived, but then reportedly committed suicide by firing a shotgun with his paralyzed toe. Now Irene's third husband has been murdered while sitting in his living room, waiting for someone. If there is one axiom good investigators rely on, it's that previous behavior is an indicative predictor of future behavior. Because similar to what happened the last time a hit was put out on one of her husbands, Irene was conveniently far away from the crime scene when Ron Thomas was killed.
And of course, you know, Irene left Ron home by himself to give herself an alibi. But when she came home and found Ron murdered and called 911, the investigator, when he arrived and started talking to her at the crime scene and asking her questions, she stopped him at one point and says, well, do I need an attorney? And the investigator says, well, I don't know. Do you think you need an attorney? And as soon as he said that, she said, I'm not going to say no more. I want my attorney.
Most people whose significant other has just been found murdered are usually beside themselves, stricken by shock and sorrow. They can react in unexpected ways, yet predictable under the banner of acute emotional pain that generally accompanies shocking loss. If Irene's reaction wasn't suspicious enough, what she did in the weeks before Ron Thomas's murder more or less confirmed her involvement.
Funny thing I found out was, I thought real unique, was Irene had taken a big insurance policy out on him, like a $150,000 insurance policy out on Ron. And a month before Ron is murdered, she calls her insurance agent, who she's had for years, and asked the insurance agent that if Ron would just so happen to be shot to death, would she still get the $150,000 if he died in that matter? And the insurance agent actually told, oh yeah, sure you will. You know, now if that's not suspicious, I don't know what is.
It was actually $300,000 in life insurance that Irene ended up collecting after Ron Thomas's murder. A considerable bump from the $90,000 she pocketed after her second husband's suicide, and a seemingly larger increase from the undisclosed sum she made from her first husband's untimely death.
When she got that, all that big clumps of money because of her behavior and her decisions, then that showed her how easy she'd get money with insurance. And that planted that seed in her brain. That's what I'm thinking.
With Ron Thomas, do you think she hired somebody or?
I think she promised somebody, yeah. I think she promised somebody some of the insurance money once he was murdered.
Is it possible that Ron could have been killed by someone Dick Weston sent there because Ron got away from being charged in the Stevenson murders?
I'd say it would be more than likely one of Irene's.
The name David Bell mentions seems to come out of nowhere. It's someone close to Irene who was never named in any official documents. I trust Bell's investigation and the off-the-record information he has provided me. This is why giving cold cases a second look is so crucial. Detective Bell stepped in with a new set of eyes, a new way of looking at things. It's these reasons why the name he mentions is credible to me.
I got a written statement from a guy who said that his former wife was a friend of Irene's, and it was his understanding that Irene killed William Floyd. So if he would kill William Floyd, he'd sure kill Ron Thomas.
But why would this person carry out such a heinous act for someone like Irene? Knowing her penchant for cashing in on insurance money was an obvious motivating factor, as well as the common theme that connects us back to why so many people in this story have wound up dead. Greed.
How many people do you have to set up for murder your husband to be construed as a black widow? I will admit that her first husband was kind of, she was just indirectly involved with his untimely death. She didn't plan on him trying to beat that train, you know, but I think it's ironic that not only did she claim the insurance on him, she also filed a civil suit against the train company, you know, and then the same thing with the motel. She filed a civil suit for William's death, which she is the one that initiated it, you know, and caused it. And in my opinion, I mean, I think, in fact, I think it was the FBI that pinned her with the Black Widow title. You know, because she's the one that confessed to the FBI about all this with William Floyd.
As it turns out, Irene Floyd met with the FBI on three separate occasions back in 1981 and 1982. She confessed her role in the near-fatal beating of her second husband, William Floyd, and admitted to receiving instructions from Ron Thomas on how to tip off the assailants after she and William arrived at their motel room in Memphis.
And of course, you know, she did recant her confessions to the FBI. She never gave a reason why she recanted. She just denied that she ever confessed to the FBI. Of course, I confirmed with the FBI that she in fact did.
Irene made official statements to the feds. She couldn't take back what she admitted. But in a twisted bit of luck for Irene, the documents were filed away and seemingly lost within what can be an endless system of too much information and too small of a budget to hire more investigators. That is, until the early 2000s, when the Richland County Sheriff's Department in South Carolina decided to reopen Ron Thomas's homicide case. After coming across Irene's damning statements, as well as her lawsuit against the motel, Richland County decided there was enough evidence to charge Irene Thomas with conspiracy to commit murder in the near-fatal beating of her second husband.
That's the one I got her indicted for the conspiracy to kill Bill Floyd, because she did all the conspiring in Columbia, in Richland County, which was our jurisdiction.
Irene Thomas was arrested and detained for 5 days before being released on $25,000 bail. If convicted, she would face up to 5 years in prison or a $5,000 fine. This shocks and disturbs me. Conspiracy to commit murder, and the worst punishment is only 5 years in prison, of which we know will be decreased to less time. The system is broken. Did she ever do any time for that crime?
Not to my knowledge, no. We had a sorry excuse for a solicitor at the time, you know, a prosecutor. And he wasn't real big on cold cases and trying to prosecute cold cases, because he thought it would be too much effort. And he was afraid of losing a cold case because they're harder to prove and not get reelected. That was his problem. My understanding is she was never brought to trial.
So you really believe that Irene was the one who had a hand in Ron Thomas's murder?
Oh, no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind.
To think about all the pain and suffering, not to mention the innocent lives lost at the behest of Ron Thomas, is to truly understand that a sociopath lacks the basic emotion to love, to care about people, that he puts himself, as narcissists do, ahead of the world. The torment Ron Thomas had planned, caused, and inflicted lasted long after he was killed. Despite Ron's death in 1991, it would be 13 years before Carol Thompson and her daughter Shannon would learn about the fate of the second man responsible for killing their family. Imagine, over a decade, and nobody called them. Nobody sent a letter. Nobody emailed. Nothing.
You know, this whole time, my mom's watching over her back, scared to death her whole life, and angry, and just, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I remember I dropped everything. I called my mom here in Ohio. Got her out of bed. I'm like, you have got to go downstairs. I have to get this to you. So she goes down. She fires up her computer. And I don't tell her. I just send her the link. And, oh, it was crazy. Like she said, it was a bombshell. It was insane. We never imagined in a million years.
After learning about Ron's death, Shannon called the prison to get an update on the other man who killed her family, Dick Weston. The prison informed her that Dick had been released. Shannon absolutely lost it. How could this be happening? The DOJ ultimately called back and said they made a mistake. Dick Weston had actually died while in prison. There's no explanation for how such a mind-blowing misstep like this can happen. It's a seemingly innocent mistake, but one that can set off a debilitating new wave of trauma and fear for victims' families.
My mom and I made a holiday of the day Ron was murdered. I mean, it's horrible, but it's cookie crumb day. It's the day to be thankful for the little cookie crumbs that life gives you. You know, that it, I don't know, it just meant a lot to us.
It never surprises me how victim family members react to trauma of losing someone to murder, or how victims' families are treated. Each person deals with the shocking realities in their own way. I've seen this in my own family. My brother, for example, after his pregnant wife was strangled to death, spent the next several years killing himself with drugs and alcohol. He succeeded. So I never judge those who, like Carol Thompson, find ways in which to deal with this sort of all-consuming grief.
What did you think when you heard that Irene might be behind Ron's murder?
I loved it because the reason that I loved it, I mean, there could have been a better person. I really hope it was her, because he betrayed my family. He was their friend, their trusted friend, and he betrayed them and killed them for their money. So if his wife betrayed him, oh my gosh, there's just no better. I mean, if I couldn't do it, that would be the next best thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Carol presents herself as a resilient, irrepressible woman. To some, she can come across as too animated or blunt, emotionless, if you will, when recalling some of the darkest moments of her life. But it's her life, her story, her experience. Carol gets to respond in any way she needs to.
I'm glad if she is the one who did it, I'm really super glad that she betrayed him. And I hope he knew that. I hope in the last seconds of his, you know, his miserable life, I hope in those last seconds that, you know, he knew he was betrayed. I think that would be a little bit of justice. You know, it's just a shame that Ron skated right under the, you know.
He skated, but in the end, he, you know, he got a bullet in the back of his head.
Yeah, it's not good enough, but it's good. I mean, it's what it is. I wish it was more.
I mean, a trial and life in prison would have been better, I think.
Would have been great, yeah. Or me to actually kill him, because I truly did. I wanted to kill him right on the courthouse steps. That was my fantasy, you know, kill him on the courthouse steps where everybody could see.
And you'd have done it, Carol?
Absolutely. Yes, I think I would have done it. I mean, it sounds terrible. Could you be that cold? But yeah, you know, when I think about it, you know, the flashes, I get pictures in my head of Mom's body and little Billy, you know, little Billy. All I got to do is think about little Billy, and yes, I'd pull the trigger. Absolutely. Because you know what? There's other babies out there. And he was dangerous. I don't care what anybody said. He was dangerous. And they weren't getting him. You know, and it's just a shame because, you know, I don't know. They knew who he was. And that, I mean, I understand if you can't get evidence on somebody, but I don't know. You know, there was quite a bit of circumstantial evidence. I would have rather them taking to court with the circumstantial evidence and lost than not have tried it on.
Luckily for David Bell, he picks it up like 10 years later and, you know, pursues it. And David Bell, he's like, look, I brought this case to my prosecutors and they didn't want to do anything. I told them, Ron, I found evidence Ron was involved.
How can they do that? How can you do that?
It's up to them. It's up to them to say, yeah.
I know, but you know what? It doesn't make any sense to me in the grand scheme of the world. It doesn't make any sense to me how you can let a person who planned and actually, you know, made it happen, a quadruple murder, including that of a child, and you know who this person is, and if you've got this evidence, you've got these police, you know, bringing it to your desk, and you know that this person will probably do something like this again, how do you not pursue it?
Not everyone grieves in the same way. Carol has suffered through horrible trauma, the likes of which most of us will never experience. She's felt the shock, the denial, the guilt, the anger, the fear. But there's no magic solution to help escape the kind of pain you feel when your entire family has been executed and justice has not been served. Having told Carol everything I've uncovered during my investigation, I asked her if the information has helped in any way.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all I've ever wanted was, you know, Ron's dead. I can't, you know, they can't do anything with him now, but yes, I mean, I've always wanted the story known for what it truly happened and who did it. One of the things that has always haunted me is, you know, 100 years in the future, Ron's great, great grandchildren, you know, they're going to look back and they're going to go, oh, our poor great, great grandfather. He was a good, upstanding man. He was such a good man and he was murdered and they never even found out who killed him. Poor, poor man. Now, no, I don't want that. I mean, and that's always been my driving thing, really. That's always been in my head.
Dick Weston was dead. Ron Thomas was dead. But the woman authorities believe orchestrated Ron's murder managed to somehow evade any repercussion, same as he did. Yet, like Ron, Irene Floyd's life of freedom wouldn't last long. In one of the more bizarre twists in this entire case, a last dose of karma, perhaps. What ended up happening next is the moment you look at and just have to ask yourself, what the hell is going on in this case? Because for one, It was well known among friends that Irene Floyd was terrified of water. And yet in 2012, Irene Floyd, the Black Widow, was found dead in a friend's swimming pool. The cause of death? Drowning. Paper Ghosts is written and executive produced by me, M. William Phelps, and iHeartRadio executive producer Christina Everett, with script consultant Matthew Riddle. Audio editing and mixing by Abu Zafar. Thanks to Will Pearson at iHeartRadio. The series theme, number 442, is written and performed by Thomas Phelps and Tom Mooney. And one final thank you to Lauren Bright Paccio, who I cannot thank enough for all she has done for me. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.